A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights probably gone.
So had the stairs.
You are just number six.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 482. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are continuing our discussion about Four Feather Falls. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
This is one of our regular visits to the worlds of Gerry Anderson with an early puppet show of his. It broadcast on ITV in 1960. I believe all of the episodes were produced in 59, and it had 39 episodes in total that were about 12 minutes each, so short episodes. And it is a Western show rather than a science fiction that he did in most of the later ones, but it has lots of magical elements to it. Explicitly, magic exists in this world, which is why we decided it was suitable for us to cover it. And it's also a sort of key moment in the transition of a number of things with Gerry Anderson and moving into the Super Marionation series that he would do throughout the 1960s.
And that transition stage we will come back to, because it is one of the fascinating things about this show.
Absolutely.
So let's carry on a little bit with the story and say that Four Feather Falls is a somewhat stereotypical Western pioneer town, familiar to viewers at the time from the various Western shows popular on television. Four Feather Falls has got its general store, it's got the saloon, it's obviously got the sheriff's office for Tex Tucker, it's got the jail that's attached to that. There's a horse corral we see at various points. We get the sort of various sort of stores and buildings that you'd assume to find, or you would expect to find in a pioneer town. And later on in the series, we'll get the big excitement when the railway finally comes to Four Feather Falls. So we get that sort of development that we expect from pioneering townsfolk at the time, but also from the shows that people were watching on television at the time.
Yes, it fits very much into the feel of the 1950s black and white Western TV series. And in this case, it's done with puppets rather than done live action. And we do get some riding stunts done by the puppets, which is kind of neat. There's some pretty impressive work there. And we get characters and ideas which borrow from the history of the American West and the things that we would see in the Western popular culture at that point. They have a dentist called Doc Hegarty, so not quite Doc Holliday, and doesn't turn out to be a killer, but we have these sort of regular, typical types of characters we would expect. We have them in Four Feather Falls.
Indeed we do, yes. Some interesting characters, because the town is visited by certain roguish or villainous characters. A salesman who wants to deceive and steal from the locals. There's various gangsters or fraudsters who prop up from time to time. Of course, there are the frequent sort of mad plots by Pedro and Fernando, which Tex Tucker can usually defeat fairly easily. And we've also mentioned that the sheriff and the residents of Four Feather Falls generally live in peace with the Native Americans around them. But there's a couple who seem to be renegade and cause them trouble. There's Red Scalp, who seems to be very much going against the trend in causing trouble for Tex and the team. And there's also this rather unfortunately named Indian Joe, who crops up at least once as well. They seem to threaten the friendly coexistence that we've seen otherwise.
Yeah, it was interesting that a lot of the indigenous characters and the sort of major group of them are considered friendly. And of course, there were others that were not. But yeah, there were stereotypes there and various issues. We'll get to that a bit more. But as we've mentioned, this is sort of the Anderson team in transition, and that is one of the most interesting things to talk about with this show. And we've now looked at pretty much all of the major shows that Gerry Anderson did that were broadcast during the 60s, from Supercar, which followed this, to Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, all the way through to The Secret Service and the end of the 60s.
Yeah, quite a range of shows we've covered.
Yeah, absolutely. And Four Feather Falls sees Gerry Anderson breaking away from the working relationship he had with Roberta Lee, and then during the series, breaking away from the working relationship he had with Arthur Provis. And they were business partners as well, and that ended at that point.
And of course, he's forming another partnership in 1960 when he marries Sylvia Anderson, and they become the powerhouse couple working on this show, but in particularly becoming the vitally important production team for all those great shows that's to follow in the 1960s. Obviously, they divorced later on, but they were really the sort of heart of the Anderson Productions for all those big shows.
Yes, absolutely. They were co-producers for something like 15 years on a whole variety of shows, and they had lots of things happening there. Sylvia Anderson became very heavily involved in all of these productions.
And of course, it's this time on this show that they're developing the new puppetry technologies that will define his science fiction shows. We talked last time about the lip-syncing solenoids, the tungsten steel wires, the famous overhead puppeteer's bridge, various new technologies that the Slough warehouse gave them the room to use. Because this was, of course, when they first started in Slough, and they get those bigger sets, bigger puppets, and indeed, I might say, bigger ideas, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. During the 60s, with these Super Marionation shows, each show would only last for a year or two and then be replaced by something else. And they were always trying to do something new and bigger and better with the new shows. So you really see a lot of sort of maturing and progressing over the time. And it was also around this time that Anderson started to see the benefits of merchandising and tie-ins to the show. There were comic strips for Four Feather Falls that ran in TV Comic, which was a very successful comic at that point. And there was also an annual for Four Feather Falls that was written by Sylvia Anderson. And they even had a tie-in board game for this show.
Yeah, well done if you've still got a Four Feather Falls board game.
I'm guessing you don't have yours hanging around.
I don't have one of those or any Four Feather Falls comic strips at all, Brian, but yeah, it would be interesting to see some.
So we should get into some of the depictions of different characters in here. And we've talked about things being a little uncomfortable. And this is really a show from the 1950s. Broadcast was in 1960, but it was produced in 59. And it really comes out of 1950s popular culture and the 1950s Western genre. And unfortunately, that does mean there are a lot of stereotypes there and some things that are uncomfortable. And it's very much of its time, but it's something that we should talk about.
Yes. Now, we have noted as we've gone along that this is rather unusual because it shows the residents of Four Feather Falls living quite peacefully with nearby Native Americans. These characters, of course, are important to the origin story of both Four Feather Falls and Tex Tucker, but they are still, even though they're peacefully coexisting, they're sculpts on the indigenous characters. The way they're voiced is rather stereotypical, and that makes for a slightly uncomfortable watch and listen now, I'm afraid.
Yes, it really is full of stereotypes, but it is nice that we don't have, you know, circling the wagons against the oncoming attack of the tribe. We don't have that, which is to their credit that they didn't include that.
Yeah, I think that is one of the most interesting aspects, in a way, of the storytelling, that they don't do that. Although, as we've said, that still allows them to have characters like Red Scalp, who is a rather villainous native person. I think I said Indian Joe. I think he's Indian Jack, although that's slightly confusing because I think he is, if I remember rightly, Brian, he's masquerading as a native. And there's some sort of confusion there about his actual origins. But in terms of the voicing and the way the characters are sort of designed and the headdresses, the costuming, yeah, it's a bit strange. Plus, we've got the sort of the trope of the magical native creating the magic that is part of the world of Four Feather Falls.
Yeah, the series sort of hangs on that. The almost witch doctor-like portrayal. And in the intro for this, some of the music they use brings in some stereotypes and the sound of it there too.
Unfortunate stuff. Now, if they've treated most of the indigenous people fairly well in this show, we can't say the same for the portrayal of people from Mexico, particularly our recurring, rather foolishly portrayed villains, Pedro and Fernando, who are just depicted as being stupid and villainous the whole time.
And cowardly as well.
And cowardly, yes. It's difficult to watch now, Brian.
It is, yeah. And this is typical stuff for 1950s Westerns. And it's clearly uncomfortable and it was wrong, but it was what was accepted at the time. And, you know, we need to be aware of that. There were one or two black characters included in this as well, particularly Big Ben, who was one of the villains, and there were stereotypical things there as well.
Yeah, unfortunate stuff. Now, obviously, we watch this in 2025, and we watch it with the eyes and ears of people, you know, used to television now. We're not watching it with the eyes and ears of a child in 1960. I would say, Brian, that we occasionally get a little bit of pushback from listeners because we judge old shows by modern standards. But it is sort of difficult to ignore in a way, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We can only use our own perspective. We're not in 1960. And I think there are a couple of extremes here where you can say this is old, so we can't talk about any problems or issues with it. We have to view it as if it were that time. And then there's the other extreme of saying there are these problems with it, therefore the show has nothing to offer and we have to dismiss it completely. I think we need sort of a balanced approach of being aware that it's from that era and knowing that these were things that were common at the time and were accepted at the time, even though they shouldn't have been. And we need to examine those issues and be aware of it and choose to, if we want, watch and enjoy those, but from a place of awareness of knowing that, yeah, those were problems. So that's what we're trying to do here, is to be aware of all the issues and at the same time be aware of the context that it comes from as well.
And we will get to this in a moment, but we are looking at it with our modern eyes, thinking about whether we recommend this to other people who might want to watch it themselves or show it to others. And I think that context is important. I know back in the 50s and in 1960, as you say, Brian, a lot of this stuff would have just gone by without anybody blinking and just, you know, it was the norm back then. But it does, as ever, make us look at this stuff and think about what was being portrayed on screen.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that brings us into talking about our own thoughts about this more than we have already. So, Eamon, what did you like about Four Feather Falls?
Well, I think this is a show where it's great to see the technology improving. We have seen Torchy the Battery Boy. we've seen little bits and pieces of the adventures of Twizzle, and this show marks a considerable step up, both in the look of the puppets, but also in their operation. And I think the technology and the puppetry, it's a real advance on this one, Brian.
Yes, I would agree that it is more sophisticated, and the way they move and have guns firing and the things with the horses, as you mentioned, there are definitely steps up there. I will also say that the look of the puppets with their faces, I thought some of them were really well done. The grandfather especially, these were really sort of expressively designed, sort of caricatures in a way, but they were nicely designed and sculpted faces, I thought, for both people and animals, actually.
Yeah, no, they're really good, actually. It's nice to see them, you know. I mean, obviously, we've got the larger head puppets that we associate with the sort of the first part of the 1960s up until, I guess, we get to Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons. But that's to allow the extra technology inside the heads. Some of the sculpts are really, really very impressive indeed. As I say, we're slightly uncomfortable when they drift into the obvious racial stereotypes. But some of the sort of regular residents' faces are just great.
Yeah, and I think some of the voice performances were sort of a step in the right direction. There were some nice ones there.
Now, I recognize the late, great Nicholas Parsons from his work, particularly on the radio show Just a Minute. I must admit, I didn't really hear his voice as Tex Tucker. He's doing a remarkable job with his American accent. Doesn't sound like the Nicholas Parsons we would learn to love much later on. But I think, yeah, the vocal performances are great. Kenneth O'Connor is the master of doing funny and silly voices, particularly for Dusty and Rocky, I think are great. So yeah, some of the performances, both by the puppeteers and by the voices, are really fantastic.
Yeah, in voices, I think David Graham is a standout with the grandfather and some other characters, and you can see why he became such a big part of some of the Super Mario Nation shows that would follow this one.
You know I love David Graham. You know I love the idea of Gerry Anderson forming this team that he was going to work with. I love the idea of the warehouse in Slough, and it's all starting to come together here, Brian. David Graham and some of his other regular sort of collaborators. Barry Gray's there already, obviously. Yeah, I love all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the way that characters move and that sort of thing, it's all starting to become more like the 1960s Super Mario Nation era that we know.
And while I mentioned Barry Gray, we should say that the music's quite fun. The songs are quite catchy. Michael Holliday's impression of Bing Crosby and Gene Autry is pretty good. You know, you can see why it became an EP and that people might have wanted to put that on the record player.
Yeah, it is a bit repetitive. We hear one or two songs quite a few times, but yeah, there was some nice stuff they were doing with the music for sure.
If we mention things that are a bit repetitive, I suppose we have to get to the storylines and the plots. And we're starting to drift into some of the bad things about this show, Brian.
Yeah, I think we do need to move to some of the more negative things. So yeah, go ahead.
Well, they're 12-minute episodes. There's a bad guy. There's some daft plot. Tex Tucker will solve it all with his magic guns and with the assistance of Dusty and Rocky. They do get a bit boring and repetitive, just sort of, particularly if you're playing them on, you know, play all like I was. It does get very samey. And as you say, those six songs just keep coming up again and again, don't they?
Yes. As you say, it is repetitive. And in a 12-minute time slot, you don't get very much in the way of interesting plots. But it's from an era of children's TV where they felt the need to sort of dumb things down a bit and possibly talk down to the audience. And yeah, the stories and the, you know, the adventures, the episodes, they're not all that good. You know, they're okay, but it just isn't that interesting, especially compared to what would come in the few years.
And this is interesting because you've got an idea about this, Brian, because the 1950s television is still trying to work out how to do children's TV and to actually produce something that's entertaining and informative. And there's going to be a game changer that's going to come along in a year or two, Brian.
Yes, as I see it in British children's television and family television, things aimed at least partially at children, there is before Doctor Who and after Doctor Who. And once Doctor Who came out, you had things for children that were not talking down to them and had more interesting drama, and that changed everything. I think that's when people started realizing that children were up to watching things that were pretty interesting and were capable of absorbing sophisticated stories and more complicated ideas. And at this point, we're still very much before that, and we have watched a few things now that were before that, and you can really see that it is, you know, very heavily packaged as simplified children's television, and this sort of suffers because of that, I think.
Yeah, very much so. Interesting, you know, as I say, this is a 1950s show, although it comes out in 1960, and the 1950s and early 60s shows we've watched have been quite simple in terms of children's TV. 1963, something enormous is going to happen on television, and thank goodness it did, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And when you... if you compare this to Stingray, which was only a few years later for Gerry Anderson, it's completely night and day. You know, they're doing real adventure stories there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it's a real shake-up for Gerry Anderson and his team, and they reacted and produced something really impressive.
Yeah, and you know, we sort of go in steps that we have something more sophisticated than this in Supercar, and then it moves up a little from that to Fireball XL5, still sort of a little bit on the silly side, but, you know, getting more interesting. And then by the time you're at Stingray, you're really in a different era from this.
Yeah. Great stuff to come. Not necessarily all that great stuff in Four Feather Falls, then. We have talked already about the difficult issue of racial stereotyping, both in sculpts, costuming, and voicing. Do we need to say any more about that? I think the listeners probably know how I feel about it, Brian.
Yeah, you know, it's something that is very definitely there. You can't avoid it. We haven't mentioned sexism in this, but it's sort of what you'd expect. There is very little involvement from women in this show. There's one character or two, and they're very peripheral.
Indeed, yes.
But yeah, the combination of those things and the fact that it's just quite a simple show that is not very interesting yet. It's that earlier era of children's TV. That combination of things really limits things.
Possibly mostly of interest to us because of the transitional period this represents in Anderson's career, where it is in terms of those shows that he's going to go on and produce and that we have talked about already, Brian.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to try a couple of comparisons here. I know this is not going to make it onto your top five of Super Mario Nation shows, but if you are going to watch something for fun or show it to someone else, would you choose Four Feather Falls or Torchy the Battery Boy between those two?
Oof. That's a tricky one, Brian. I think I would choose Four Feather Falls just because of the advances in technology, but I would want to have a conversation in advance, a sort of content warning about some of the depictions that they're going to see. And I suppose also a slightly lesser content warning about the types of storytelling that this still is a little bit primitive in that respect. What about yourself? Torchy versus Four Feather Falls?
I would go with Torchy the Battery Boy.
Oh, right. Interesting. Okay.
Because it has out there science fiction-y things that are a little absurd but fun.
Right.
Now, what if we add a third show into that? Let's add Roberta Lee's Space Patrol into the mix. So those three, which one are you picking?
Goodness, I think Space Patrol, actually. I think it would go Space Patrol, Four Feather Falls, Torchy in that order for me. Just because, again, science fiction concepts and there's some interesting stuff going on in that. It's been a while, but yeah, I think I would put that one ahead, unfortunately. What about yourself, Brian?
I would also put Space Patrol ahead in that group of three. Now, I'm going to add a fourth one, but I'm only doing one more.
Okay.
So let's add Supercar to the mix.
That's a tricky one. I would certainly put Supercar ahead of Four Feather Falls and Torchy. Whether I would pick Space Patrol or Supercar, I seem to remember being quite bored by the supercar stories and being more interested in the science fiction of Space Patrol. So I'd narrow win for Space Patrol for me, I think. Supercar goes into second place or races into second place. Four Feather Falls drops to third and Torchy is lingering in the rear for me. So yourself, Supercar or Space Patrol?
For me, it's Space Patrol. So my ranking is Space Patrol, then Supercar, then Torchy the Battery Boy, then Four Feather Falls at the bottom.
Okay, so we only disagree about the last two.
That's right, yeah.
Interesting exercise.
Yeah, I thought it was a fun one looking at some of those early puppet shows. I think we would both agree that when we start bringing in the later color ones, those are going to be higher up on our lists.
Yes, I'm going to throw all of those shows away in favor of the color shows. Right, okay, so I guess we're getting close to recommendation time on Four Feather Falls, Brian.
Yes, I think we are. Would you like to start?
Okay. I would say that I'm not going to recommend Four Feather Falls. It is of academic or possibly nostalgic interest only. It does have a lot of problematic elements. I don't think I would show it to children now. I might show it to older children as a sort of an example of television history with an advisory about some of the content it's going to be in there. But no, on the whole, I'm not going to recommend Four Feather Falls unless you really want to see this transitional period, the transitional technology for Gerry Anderson and his team. What about yourself, Brian? Which way are you going to go on Four Feather Falls?
I am not going to recommend Four Feather Falls. Yes, there is some historical interest, but even then, no. I think there are so many much better choices in these early black and white puppet shows and the color puppet shows that would follow them. So no, there are much better things out there, and I will not recommend Four Feather Falls.
Okay, but as ever, if you think we've got it wrong on this early Gerry Anderson show, please get in touch on the socials and let us know what you think. And if you think we are right or wrong to sort of watch these old shows through modern eyes, again, get in touch. We've had some conversations about that in the past. I expect we'll get some in the future as well.
Very good. So, in summary, Four Feather Falls introduces us to Sheriff Tex Tucker in the Wild West, who, at the beginning of the series, saves the life of an indigenous child whose father grants Tex Tucker these four magic feathers that allow his horse and his dog to speak and allow his guns to fire without him having to even touch them. And there is also a waterfall that is created at the same time, and the town of Four Feather Falls is established there, and we get this Western series of adventures with Tex Tucker and a young boy and his grandfather, and they are set against various bandits and villains and so on in classic Western cowboy style.
Do get in touch and let us know what you thought.
Absolutely.
And please come back and join us next time. We are moving to a much more modern show. I think we're on much safer territory. We are looking at the BBC's 2018 adaptation of China Mieville's novel, The City and the City. And I confess, Brian, as ever, I'm really looking forward to this one.
Yes, the jump of close to 60 years forward will be a nice one in this case, I think.
Great stuff.
Until then, you can find all of our episodes, including the coverage of Gerry Anderson's Super Mario Nation shows, at BritishInvaders.com. And if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find us there. And you can follow us on Instagram and on Threads. We are at British_Invaders_podcast on both of those platforms.
We are also on the platform of The Voice of Geeks at vognetwork.com. The Voice of Geeks is a network of podcasts, gaming shows, Twitch streaming, other content, all sorts of interesting stuff going on with The Voice of Geeks at vognetwork.com.
Absolutely. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Until next time, Eamon in England also signing off.